Good evening, everyone, and happy Shabbat. My pleasure to be with you. We've got James, Kirk, and Larry. Hi, guys.
Good evening.
Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat. What I was hoping we could do today, unless somebody has something they'd like to cover first, is to turn back to a proverb that we covered months ago briefly. We never got to the end of it, and we were fairly limited in our commentary on it. And it, after having spent considerable time analyzing Shamuel, 1 Samuel 7, 8, and 9, and completing those chapters for observation, I had to go back to Proverbs 6 and give it my best shot. Be more diligent on the translations and thoughtful on the commentary. And what I have discovered is that Yahweh's primary advice is to be politically incorrect. He wants us to hate. He wants us to disassociate. He wants us to be discerning, discriminating, judgmental. He wants us to be non-political, non-religious, and extremely hostile to those things. It is a treatise on why it's in our interest to be politically incorrect. You know, God couldn't run for political office today. He couldn't get elected to be dog catcher.
True.
So it's a...
You know what? They'd probably crucify him.
They might. Yeah, I guess that's the last time he tried.
You know, I mean, to say he couldn't be elected is talk about an understatement. I think he sends two guys here at the end, right? To tell the world the truth, and they're all going to applaud when they're finally dead in the streets over there in Jerusalem, and that would be Enoch and Eliyah. My favorite. I'm sure Eliyah will be poking fun at him while he does it, which I will absolutely love.
Yeah, but, yeah. You know. Moshe is pretty no nonsense, but Eliyah, I think he's going to have some fun with him. He's got that streak in him.
Yeah,
I think it will be fun. So you know, I've begun this chapter with the antithesis of the way that people would approach any audience today. And the first line is, hate is a virtue. I mean, they have those ads that run today on sporting events and every place else that's for the society or something, Society for Better Living, and it's values.com, pass them on. And, you know, it's the whole thing is to be loving and accepting and forgiving and multicultural and understanding. My first four words are, hate is a virtue. The next five are, it's good to hate. Now, I came up with that towards
you
the end.
You probably couldn't be elected either.
No.
No, I couldn't. No, no. Not even for dog catcher. And no. I came up with that when I was covering Islam, because there was a bunch of people after some of the more recent terrorist acts, mass murder in Paris and then the mass murder in San Bernardino, where all of the Muslim apologists came out and said, we ought not hate. And my response was immediately, oh, yeah, we should.
Mm-hmm.
Hating is the only rational response. And I did a number of guest radio appearances and other shows on hate and why hate is absolutely necessary. So, you know, it's a fairly simple concept. Do you hate rape and rapists?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you hate pedophiles and pedophilia?
Sure.
Hate kidnapping and kidnappers, the slave trade and slave traders?
How could you not?
Yeah. Do you hate terrorism, attacks on defensive civilians and terrorists that perpetrate them? I do.
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I do.
And I think it's appropriate.
I hate what they're doing worldwide to people. I really do. Yeah. And and if you could eliminate those people, would you do it? Yeah. I mean,
So go one step further. And by the way, there's a better way to eliminate those people than to kill them, which is to expose and condemn the vicious, disgusting, religion that inspires them. So that, you know, I would ask people, and I did these radio shows, I said, so if there was a neo-Nazi group out there that put in writing and preached that God wanted you to rape everyone that doesn't agree with the neo-Nazis, and that you are free to kill them, you're free to terrorize them, you're free to have sex with their children. This is what the God of the neo-Nazis is advocating, and the only way for you to be a good neo-Nazi and go to Valhalla for the neo-Nazis is to do these things. Would you endorse that, apologize for it, or would you condemn it?
I condemn it.
So what if the club was their religion? Let's still condemn it. Why does our disgust and condemnation somehow wane when the inspiration for terrorism and mass murder and the slave trade is a religion?
There's no religion. They're the same path to God.
Oh yeah, sure they are.
Well, the reason that happens is because people are afraid of being called.
They're all
politically incorrect. They're afraid of being called politically incorrect. That's all it is. That's all it is. That's what stops it. There's not one reasonable person in the world that wouldn't condemn it and wouldn't point it out. But most people will never cross that line for fear that they're actually upsetting somebody, especially from a religious standpoint. And by the way, that comes from that's the Christian standpoint, isn't it? Respect all religions.
Yeah, it's also the secular humanist approach.
Yeah, and although they hate religion, they want to respect one of them.
I don't think that was always the case in Christianity. They hated all religions.
Christianity hated all rivals, and there's still an enormous amount of anti-Semitism in Christianity, and still, you know, there's a lot of Islamic hate. But the fact is, so long as the target of your righteous indignation is things which are harmful, then hate is a virtue. And when I first said that, it was eminently logical, it was eminently moral, it was eminently rational to say so. But I knew that there were places where God says he hates. I had no idea that God had such a laundry list of things he hates. And what he says, there are six things in this list that we're going to consider that he says he hates, and that seven are an abomination. Now, that's good enough for me. But, you know, the thing that is that I like, I had a long conversation with a guy yesterday, who was raised a Roman Catholic and now is an agnostic. And we started talking about the disgusting nature of the Roman Catholic Church and the false nature of Christianity. And I told him, you know, the guy happens to be a landscape guy. And pretty squared away guy. He said, I think you'd actually like God. I don't blame you for not liking a God of religion. That God's, I mean, talk about insecure. He wants you to bow down and pray to him. And what kind of a God would want you to do that? And I said, but the real God, you know, man's man. He means fun to hang with. Somebody that's eminently respectable and likable. Somebody you would want to spend your eternity with. And part of what makes him intriguing is that he knows what to hate and not afraid to say it. So as we approach this particular proverb, it is... It has two things, and really only two things. One is that we ought to disassociate from all manner of human institutions. We ought to disrespect them. We ought to come to know what is the motivation and the impetus behind them, and then we ought to expose them and condemn them, and we ought to despise them for the harm they create. So it's the antithesis of the respect and multiculturalism and acceptance themes of socialist secular humanism and political correctness. And the second theme is that there are things worthy of hate, and that hate is the proper response to a wide variety of human endeavors. That is the theme of this proverb. Now, in that, there are great insights. God is trying to prepare us, to educate us, so that we will not fall prey to religious schemes such as Christianity, so that we will not be fooled by the likes of Paul. He's doing his best to present another insight that I don't know if it's been articulated anyplace else. I've never heard it anyplace else. But it became obvious to me as I was reading Yeshayah, Isaiah, and then as I was writing about Islam and Prophet of Doom. People have Satan completely wrong. You know, they think that you're a Satanist if you go to a Satanist, occultist kind of a ceremony. If you're an avowed Satan worshiper, then they think, you know, you're in league with Satan. That is the last thing Satan wants. He doesn't want to be known as Satan. He doesn't want to be worshipped as Satan. He doesn't want satanic seances or anything like that. His interest entirely is to appear credible, to appear like God, to be worshipped in God. He doesn't want to be worshipped in the darkness of some black hole of a cult ceremony. He wants to be in the grandest, biggest, most central, most popular building in every city in America, in the world. He wants to be the Lord.
So man can't even get that right, huh?
No, and it's when you recognize that he wants to be seen as beautiful, as believable, as credible, as empowered. And so almost everything associated with Satan is when he is being worshipped as the god of mainstream religions. And he is never associated with the occultist stuff. It's just a complete and utter misconception of who Satan is and what he's trying to achieve. And in this proverb, the end of this proverb does a marvelous job of telling us precisely that. So it was something that I came to realize as I was coming to know that, you know, Allah is Satan in Islam, and that the Lord is Satan in Christianity. And Paul's God is, in fact, the adversary. And so you'd say, well, if that is how he's trying to be known in worship, then the last thing he wants is to be known as adversarial. He wants to be God, not God's adversary. And in this proverb, that is made abundantly clear. So you ask yourself, okay, if we should be hateful, and that's abundantly clear, if God doesn't want us to be political or religious, and that's abundantly clear, if we should not be fooled by the beautiful appearance of satanic religions and the mainstream nature of them, why is it that so few people articulate any of this, have come to recognize any of it?
I think that that's because it's purposely hidden. It's not discussed because, you know, if I could sit there and I could honestly say that God's with me when I openly oppose my government and I openly impose the matrix or the fabricated reality that they've surrounded me with, and I stand with God, and everybody knew those were God's words, it would be a little hard for them to attack. But as long as people are in the dark, that's pretty easy to attack.
Yeah. That's one of the themes of this proverb, is to say that you're being comatose, being apathetic, not giving a hoot, not caring what I have to say or what's happening around you. This is deadly. Now, that's the thing that gets you into trouble. And there's another place here in this proverb where God actually says the thing that we have said so often on this program, that religious people are not rational. Evidence and reason do not matter when presented in front of a Christian or Muslim. And what God says is that by associating with religion, you lose your ability to be discerning. You lose your ability to be rational. So that is the primary consequence of religion, and that as a result of losing your ability to be rational, your soul is destroyed. It's all laid out for us. So it is amazing that that God is this clear about this, and that we've all missed it for so long. So here we are. We're going to talk about this amazing proverb. It begins, "My son, if you have at some point given a pledge, and if you have joined in with a foe to be accepted, in association with your immoral country, you have bound yourself to having shaken hands with that which is illegitimate and unauthorized, foreign and estranged from the palm of my hand." Now, that is not what your King James says. So let's just look at these words, because this starts off with no pledges. That's when, you know, Yosha says, let your yes be yes, your no be no, don't make vows. This is where he got it. Don't make a pledge. No pledge of allegiance, no oath of office, no oath to as part of the military. Don't sing patriotic songs. Don't have an oath of commitment that's like the Roman Catholic Church required. Don't do any of that. My son. So this is from a father to their son. If, as a condition, as a concession, from him. And then the word that we're translating is Arab. Arab is just really a fascinating word. It's transliterated to mean Arab, as in the race. Which is interesting, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But it's from Arab, and the first thing you have to do is to think about, okay, what does Arab mean? And I've translated, given a pledge, joining in with the foe to be accepted. Why would I do that? Because Arab. Here's the basis of it. If you have at some time made an adversarial bargain or a promise in association with others to be a participant in a societal, religious, or economic institution, or taken an oath to come to the aid of others similarly pledged or associated, either providing a bond or offering a personal guarantee or agreement. In exchange or to engage in business or commerce, most especially with Arabs, and by default, of course, Muslims and OPEC, mortgaging yourself in some way, mingling in or mixing, promoting multiculturalism and tolerance, to please others so as to be accepted and welcomed, to be found acceptable. It is from R, you know, first two letters are the AR, and the AR means adversary and enemy. So this is an adversarial association, an adversarial bargain, an adversarial pledge. It was written with the call stem that frames the genuine relationship between the subject and the object, in this case the reader and their country, while the perfect conjugation speaks of a completed action, conveying the idea that while this may have been something a person has done in the past, this individual is no longer doing it. So, you know, the remedy here requires this to have been a past problem. Because God provides a remedy. He says, if you've done this, he's got a remedy. But the remedy only applies if you're no longer doing it.
First thing you got to do is quit what you're doing. You can't change your way until you stop and turn. You can't turn around until you stop.
That is correct, and that's why the tenses are so important here. All right, then, Rhea is almost always translated neighbor. But you know that Rhea, the primary meaning of Rhea is not neighbor. It is loudmouth and evil public speakers who are your fellow countrymen. Immoral country, those who comprise a troubling social, geographic, racial, or religious group. And it's from and identical to. In the text, Rhea and Ra are written identically in the text. And Ra means, in fact, Ra is the principal word for evil. No good, immoral, improper.
I remember a god named Amun-Ra. As a matter of fact,
Yeah. Yeah. Ra means evil, no good, troubling. I mean, it's Ra and Ra'ah are the principal two Hebrew words for that which is really, really bad. So if you have done that, then you have bound yourself to, having shaken hands with Tekelah, you have blown your trumpet and have pitched your tent with, you have clasped hands with, and pledged yourself to, joining with, that which is illegitimate and unauthorized, foreign and estranged. That's Hazar, the stranger who is rejected for being wrong, with the one who is completely different and born into an inappropriate marriage with the whore or a harlot, someone who is an alien. And then it's Kaf. Kaf, the letter itself, the picture of the letter, is the palm of an open hand. So if you've done these things, then you have bound yourself with that which is unauthorized and you are estranged from, the palm of my hand. The speaker here, the father that is speaking to the son, is God.
It's God.
So if you've made a pledge in the past to be accepted in, you know, to whatever the organization is, particularly one with your immoral country associated with the evil public speakers, then you have bound yourself and shaken hands with that which is illegitimate and unauthorized, foreign and estranged from the palm of my hand. And so if you've done it, you are estranged unless you accept the remedy, and God's going to provide the remedy. But if you're still doing it, if you're still patriotic, there is no remedy.
What organization doesn't have evil public speakers leading it?
None.
No, I can't find any. I'm not talking about business. You can have a small business. But of all the things we're talking about, all of them are started by or activated.
But look at this, the presidential campaign. I mean, you've got the leader there. It's Trump. You know what Trump said about, he was asked about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and he says, I'm neutral. That's like saying I'm neutral in a murder. You know, I don't know if I want to take sides with the murderer or the person they killed. You know, I'm neutral in a rape. I'm happy to rape for the rapist or the, you know, the rape victim. I'm neutral in it. How could you be neutral in something like that? Yeah, he said, I'm neutral. And he said the problem with the Bush administration authorizing torture, mm-hmm. is that their tortures weren't extreme enough. He says, I will implement tortures that are far more extreme, and they'll be effective. Then he says, you know, what our problem is that our military has been shortchanged. We need a bigger military so everybody's afraid of us. Nobody will mess with us. I mean, the guy is really screwed up, and he's the best they got.
I paid no attention to it. Is he out front or what's going on with that?
He's at 40%. The next guy is kind of a rotating door.
8% or something.
You've got Ted Cruz, who's the most avowed evangelical Christian, and almost everything his campaign has done has been deceitful, dishonest, unscrupulous. I mean, he is just. I mean, the other candidate, you know, you're an outright liar. No one in the right mind would trust you. And then is Rubio. And Rubio, no matter what
Rubio
you ask him, he's got his 3x5 card that has his 5 talking points. No matter what the question is, he goes to those 5 talking points. In fact, it was somebody, I think it was Christy the other day, that said, you know, can you provide an answer on any subject that's not part of your 5 talking points? And he started reciting his talking points.
That's got to be embarrassing to be a moron like that, just a card reader. But I have to tell you, you know, I asked one of Ted Cruz's, somebody came by on my wall and they were espousing Ted Cruz. I said, does it give you a pause that... you know, his wife was a senior vice president with Goldman Sachs. Does that give you any pause at all? And they told me, no, none.
Yeah.
I thought, wow. Wow.
Yeah, or that his father wrote that the Constitution was literally an inspired godly document.
Oh, I remember that part.
Oh, yeah, they... He's one of those, you know, America's a Christian nation.
So God's a Mason.
Well, you know, I guess if you can have Paul be inspired and contradicting God, you could have, you know, George Washington and crew inspired and contradict God. You know, one person can contradict God and be inspired, then anyone can contradict God and be inspired.
Well, I just, I find it all bizarre. I mean, I wondered who was ahead. I mean, I really have gone way out of my way not to watch anything political because I really, I just see them all as clowns. They're just clowns in a circus, you know.
Yeah.
And none of them even mean a word they say. I mean, they don't even mean anything they say. They're saying what's expedient at the moment. That's it.
Yeah.
That's
so, and
that's
then you're on the Democratic side, and you have the woman who lied every which way about Benghazi. Who
we must be talking about the witch.
Chief of staff is a Muslim who is among the most disgusting human beings that probably ever walked the face of the earth, and she's running against a communist, and the communist is whooping her.
Who's the communist? Because she's a communist herself.
No, she's very liberal. She's actually less liberal than Barack Obama, but she's, you know, she is a socialist. Barack Obama is a socialist leaning to communist. But Bernie Sanders, he says.
Oh, Bernie is
a socialist.
He's a madman. He's just a straight up madman.
Yeah, he would have you forfeit. If you're part of the 1%, then he's coming after you. His solution to everything is rob the 1%.
You know, when political actors start coming after productive people, what they really mean is if you have a job, you're going to be giving us more. That's what they really mean.
You're either paying more in taxes or you're buying them off to not get your taxes raised.
Well, I mean,
one way or another, you're paying money.
Yeah, well, they aim it at, you know, somebody that isn't you. I mean, that's the whole point, you know. But the best way of putting it, if you've got a job, they're coming after you. I mean, that's just the truth of it. You know,
if you're in a state like California and you're paying federal, state, and Social Security at 15%, well, there's nothing else to tax.
There's nothing left.
There's nobody works anymore. I mean, I wouldn't anymore double my business just because I can. Wow, for what?
Yeah, for what? Yeah, 13% state tax, and then you've got the 35%
federal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
on the independent level, and you pay both sides of the Social Security, so it's just a killer.
Yeah, that's right. Both
and
sides.
I don't have the time. I'd rather do this, but if I did, and you know, I couldn't get motivated to do it.
Now, it's interesting. Let's look at Arab here.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Arab is a fascinating Hebrew word. And we have to understand what Arab is to understand this sentence. It is a compound of R, which means adversary, foe, and enemy, and the letter B, meaning home. So it's by, with, or in the enemy, or home of the enemy. Arab could therefore be translated home of the enemy. In this regard, Israel's most numerous and most vicious, most enduring foes are Arabs, 99.9% of which are Muslims, a religion whose god, Allah, is modeled after Satan. It is also revealing that Muhammad, and therefore Muslims, see the world as divided between the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam, and Dar al-Harb. You want to take a shot as to what Dar al-Harb is?
Well,
anybody else.
The House of War. The House of Islam and the House of War. That is Dar al-Harb, and Israel lies at the epicenter of Dar al-Harb. You know, based upon its component parts, Arab means with the adversary. The term depicts any and every enemy of God or his people, but most adroitly, those individuals and institutions inspired by Hasatan, the adversary, and thus the religion of Islam, but also, to a somewhat lesser degree, Roman Catholicism, Protestant Christianity, and socialist secular humanism. Now, it's amazing how all the pieces fit together to implicate the vilest of anti-Semitic institutions. Openly acknowledging that he had been demon-possessed, Muhammad modeled his god directly after Satan. You know, Allah spends all of his time in hell. As a result, the Quran became the most anti-Semitic book ever written. You know, it says that the Jews are apes and swine, that Allah turned their heads into their asses, and that there's extra bonus points when you kill them. So trying to convince an unthinking world that criticizing Islam is bigoted as opposed to educated and rational, Arab has been promoted as being synonymous with Islam, so that critics of the religion can be dispatched as if they were racists. Yet Yahweh told us that this very thing would occur 1,600 years before Islam was even invented, correctly labeling the people Arabs, who would become Israel's most vicious foe, mankind's greatest adversary, committing 99.9% of the world's terrorist acts. Now, none of us are a fan of Winston Churchill, but it is interesting that he wrote the following in The River War. He said, individual Muslims may show some splendid qualities, but the influence of the religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Mohammedism has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step. How dreadful are the curses which Mohammedism lays on its votaries. Besides the fanatical frenzy, which is as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia in a dog, there is a fearful, fatalistic apathy towards it. The fact that in Mohammedan law every woman must belong to some man as his absolute property, either as a child, a wife, or a concubine, must delay the final extinction of slavery until the faith of Islam has ceased to be a great influence among men. End quote.
Hard to argue with that.
Very well stated. You know, say a lot about the guy, but he did know how to turn a phrase.
Yeah, he was
started
right.
As a reporter, you know. In the Boer War.
Yeah,
absolutely right, and incredibly well stated. It's just, you know, shame nobody wants to read it today.
That's correct. Now, there's more to Arab and Arabs than our Arab, the Hebrew word, than Arabs and Allah. And it, but
it also means
it
dark.
It is interesting that, you know, the Quran claims to be in pure Arabic, and of course it's supposed to be to an Arab prophet. And guess where they got the word Arab?
From Hebrew.
Hebrew.
Hebrew. And Arabic from Hebrew. As is Quran. Quran is from Kara, to read and recite. Now the whole thing is Hebrew. So most Americans have said the Pledge of Allegiance. There are countless other ways that we can, Arab, demonstrate our loyalty. A profession of faith, an oath of office, a vow to serve, a promise to pay would all qualify and thus disqualify an individual for participating in the covenant. That is, unless they take advantage of the remedy, which is to disassociate and renounce prior affiliations. It is interesting that God, in this place, now, you know, if you're looking at the terms and conditions of the covenant, which are full and complete in and above themselves, all God asks us to do is to walk away from everything associated with Babel, our country, societal systems, and the confusion of religion. Then he just says, walk away, and then trust and rely on me. And then, you know, walk to me and become perfect. Closely examine, carefully consider the terms and conditions of the relationship agreement, and finally circumcise your sons on the eighth day. There is no mention there of renouncing the prior the institution. So, can you become a member of the covenant without renouncing Christianity and politics and patriotism and militarism? Absolutely. But this is fatherly advice. And the fatherly advice is there is a remedy for you having made a pledge to your country, to your religion, to your military, or whatever it may have been. And that is to disassociate and renounce. So for God to provide advice that goes beyond the requirements of participating in the covenant, is wholly appropriate. They are not. It's not a conflict. It's not inconsistent. They both focus on walking away. But here God is saying, I want you to do more than walk away. Now, the reason I think here that God did not say that we have to denounce our country and denounce the religious aspects of Babel to be part of the covenant is the covenant is strictly between God and ourselves, not between ourselves and anyone else, between God and ourselves. And so, and it's also between ourselves and the greater us, the members of the covenant family. Denouncing religion, denouncing politics, is not something that God needs to hear. Denouncing religion, politics is not something that that the members of the covenant family need to hear. However, it is something that God wants the world to hear. That's why he made this message available to us. So as he's providing fatherly advice, he's asking us to do the right thing, to not only disassociate from those institutions, but to renounce them, because if we do that, then we are doing something that is extraordinarily valuable and worthwhile.
Well, doesn't
it change our relationship with him, but it does definitely put others in a position where they may consider what he has to say.
I'm on the wrong verse, or didn't he say that once you walk away, tell him why you walked away, at least?
Yeah, that's where we're headed. That's why I said it's not just renounce. It's not just walk away, it's renounce. Yeah, tell him. And personally, I think that's fascinating. By the way, Arabs' secondary connotation is to buy and sell, exchanging one thing for another. And so when you're thinking about buying and selling, it's hard to not to miss the world's fascination, with the OPEC Islamic countries that has fueled Islamic terrorism. In almost every mosque, I've got one in this house that we have in Ohio, and just down the street is the Islamic Center of Greater Cincinnati. And good God, is that a nice story? It just makes you want to puke every time you go by. It was built with money from OPEC. The Saudi Arabians funded it. So,
yeah, they put some 95% of all mosques around the world.
Exactly. And the most translations. Yeah, absolutely. Building them, in Saudi Arabia particularly. So, and then he says, my son. So this is the reality of what God is saying. And then he says, you lure others into relinquishing their freedom, and you yourself are ensnared and controlled by the statements of your mouth. You are caught by way of the words of your speech. God's getting right to it, right at the beginning here, which is that we do a lot of harm. When we, as a nation, get up at a ballpark and sing God Bless America, and every sporting event we do the military salute flyby and the big American flag, and everybody is cheering, when we do that, we're enticing others, luring others into relinquishing their freedoms to be, America is not a liberating existence. It's about limiting freedoms. I mean, almost every law the country passes is a limitation on freedoms. Political correctness is a grotesque limitation of what you can say and do. Now, Pacquiao, who's the fighter and a politician in the Philippines, this week said that homosexuals disgust him. And he finds homosexuality, I think, disgusting, is what he said. And so Nike withdrew their sponsorship of him because you can't say that in today's world. Now, why is it that a heterosexual man can't say, I'm disgusted by homosexuality?
He's being hemmed in. They're limiting his freedom of speech. There's not been a government created in the world to expand freedom. That's not what a government's for. It's to limit freedom. Right. And the bigger and more intrusive the government is, obviously, the more you get hemmed in and the more your freedoms are taken from you. And it's a beautiful point there. I mean, political correctness destroys freedom. That's what it's for.
Right.
To limit.
The things you can't say, even though...
Well, how far would our military get if it weren't for all of our idiotic patriotism? If every American stood up and rejected this patriotic ideal of the military can do no wrong, our military wouldn't stand a chance around the world.
Well, there's one other thing to point out here, too, and I'll quick point this out and bow out, but we also march our kids off to school, and in grade school, at least, I know when I went in there, I talked to a flag and put my hand over my heart,
and I
would feel... Yeah, well, they do. Okay, so I thought they did. There's always a flag, Both sides are always wrong.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Yeah.
So yet we're good parents when we send our kids off to school where they do exactly what Yahweh told us not to do.
Yeah. And I taught my kids, as only once I came to understand this, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was probably after the fact that they had been through grade school and done all that.
Yeah, that's why there's a remedy for the problem.
Right.
You know, we've all done it. There's a remedy for the problem.
I also did Save the Queen every morning in Australia.
Yeah, of course, yeah. That's correct. Yeah, in fact, in China right now, there's the most popular social media is to write a poem to the chairman of the Communist Party of China and tell him that, even his flagellants doesn't stink. Oh, how beautiful and noble you are. Yes.
Yeah.
So when we...
Well, that's where man is God. That's the Trinity, the evil Trinity. That's the conceited, the confused, and the conceited.
So God, our words are not harmless. We're caught by our words. Our words of our speech, they ensnare and control others. So he's trying to make us aware that, providing an oath is not an innocent thing to do. Singing one of these disgusting kinds of songs is not an innocent thing to do, because when people do it, when everybody stands up and sings the national anthem as bombers soar overhead and fighters and military officials jump out of airplanes, the crowd is endorsing that killing and destroying machine, that killing and destroying mentality. So then, decide to engage thusly, my son, and of your own free will elect to tear yourself away, delivering yourself from harm. For if, even temporarily, you have actually come to bow down before the hand, the influence, or control of your immoral country, choose to actually go in an unpretentious way, willing to get a bit dirty, and press one's reasons for contention with the adversarial individual or institution, boldly astonishing and overwhelming them, showing great courage against your loudmouth and evil public spokesman.
Loudmouth. Yeah.
So let me. So here's the advice. God said, "Don't. If you've made a pledge, then you've disassociated yourself from me, and your words matter. And I'm going to hold you accountable because they influence others." He said, "So this is my advice. So then, thusly, and this is of your own free will. It's your choice. This was expressed in the imperative mood. Imperative mood is second person volition. So decide to engage thusly, my son. And of your own free will, again expressed as the imperative mood, second person volition, of your own free will, you make your decision. Not asking you to obey me. I'm presenting the information and I'm asking you to make a choice, but the choice is yours. Of your own free will, elect to, and this is really strong words, not soft, tear yourself away, delivering yourself from harm. Choose to escape, defending yourself, saving yourself from the unfavorable circumstance. It was written in the Niffle stem. The Niffle stem indicates that by separating ourselves from these national pledges, we are spared the consequence of them. So it has the subject is both the actor and the undergoer. So that means that whatever the verb is, that the subject, if you have to look at the verb and say the subject is going to partake in that action and is going to then be influenced by it. So if you, of your own free will, elect to tear yourself away, you're going to deliver yourself from harm. So the
by
action,
the way,
yes?
That tells us something else here that I've heard often, which is often overlooked. And that is, I can be in Babylon just as Daniel was. I mean, he was a viceroy, and
yes,
still not partake in Babylon.
Right.
There's so many people that think, well, if you use the dollar bill, the petrodollar, and blah blah blah, see, you should not be doing that because now you're a part of Babylon. Well, that's not true. And you know, this is how you're separating yourself out. You might be in a matrix that's forced upon you just to live and just to eat, but at the same time, you can openly oppose it.
Right. God says, don't make an oath to your immoral country. He didn't say that you have to go swim to the nearest island.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and he's speaking to Israel, and he's saying that their enemy is Arabs. Well, the Arabs are 360 degrees. I mean, they've got the ocean and Arabs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the ocean
would be the only other option.
Right, and I gave you the land.
Program.
So he's not asking you to leave your country in the sense of physically depart. This is all about tearing yourself away from the oaths of allegiance.
That's right.
But the Niflheim stem is powerful here. That means that if you act and you disassociate, that by your act of disassociating, you will deliver yourself from the harm of those institutions. That's the impact of the Niflheim stem. The subject is both the actor and the undergoer of the verb. So there is a direct relationship. We act, moving away from, disassociating from these things, and then we are spared the harm of them. So powerful. If, even temporarily, you've actually come to bow down. So this is written in the perfect conjugation. So the same thing here with the oaths as with the bowing down, submitting. Perfect conjugation, which means if you've done it, but you're no longer doing it. It wasn't written with the imperfect. It doesn't say, you know, if you're continuing to do it, God doesn't have a
solution.
Right. It'd be the imperfect. And if you're continuing to make these oaths, if you're continuing to bow down at the hand of these immoral institutions, God does not have a remedy. He's not speaking to it. But if you've done it in the past and are no longer doing it, so perfect. You have done it, but you're no longer doing it. You're not making an ongoing practice of it. Then choose to actually go. Willing to get a bit dirty in an unpretentious way, refact, devoid of arrogance, and making the decision to tread upon them in the mud and press one reasons for contention against the loudmouthed and evil public institutions and individuals. Rea. Now, what I find interesting here is that God didn't say, you know, go inside the church. He didn't say go inside the capital. It just says confront in the sense of walk and the recognizing that as you do this, you are going to get dirty. You know, and I spent about 10 years of my life exposed to condemning Islam was filthy. It took 2 years to write Questioning Paul between writing it and rewriting it. It's disgusting. You're going to get a bit dirty. A lot of mud's going to be slung. So you are going to get dirty. Do it. Don't be arrogant about it. Do it in a way where you're openly acknowledging that you know, you're not special. You just know the truth. So you're going to bluntly present the truth in an unpretentious way, knowing that you're going to get a bit dirty. But then he says, give them reasons for your contention, which is things we do all the time. So God wants us to confront these things. You know that so many times they say that if you are hateful of a religion, you're not being like Jesus. No. This is exactly the opposite.
No, but you're being a whole lot like Yahushua.
Yeah, absolutely, because this is what he did. He confronted them.
He confronted them constantly, and he was not nice about it. He just, here it is, take it or leave it.
Matanyan, 23, where he, it's a whole chapter of hate speech. Demeaning, belittling, ostracizing, condemning. It's an entire chapter of hate speech.
But see, that's part of the tradition. That's part of the politically correct idea of religion, too, isn't it? I mean, calling Yahusha, calling the Mase the Prince of Peace. He said he came to bring division. It wasn't
peace. Yeah, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a division. Exactly.
Yeah, but if you said the Prince of Peace, I mean, that's who they think you're talking, the Prince of Peace.
Yeah, so he is the patron of reconciliation. That was what he was called in Yahshua. But in Yahshua as the patron of reconciliation, reconciliation has nothing
it has to do with the covenant people.
Political peace. He is trying to reconcile Yisrael and Yahudah to each other, making them one, and then reconciling the resulting Yisrael Yahudah with himself, with Yahweh. That's the reconciliation that he is providing. The reason he's the patron of reconciliation, when is he returning?
On the day of reconciliations. On the day of Kippurim.
Right. So people don't think it through. They just babble along and get ever more confused. Do not give yourself over to slumber, to being oblivious concerning your eyes or an altered state of awareness of your eyelids. So, what God is saying here is that, if you made a pledge, we have a problem. But here's the remedy. And the remedy is to renounce it and step forward and condemn it. And he's saying, now, you know, if you don't want to have to deal with this, that's not a solution. I had a long talk today with an individual about the nature of Islam. And he had a Muslim employee. And we went into detail about it. And what God is saying here is that your ignorance, your oblivion is not a solution. Ignorance is not bliss. It's not an excuse. Don't be ignorant about these things. Open your eyes. Examine the evidence. Be thoughtful about it. It's the Hosea 4:6 line. My people are destroyed, ceasing to exist, ceasing to even engage as a result of being ignorant, of not being perceptive, and by corrupting and negating information regarding the relationship. Hosea 4:6. So God wants us to know that being oblivious, just going along to get along, is not an acceptable answer. It'll lead to your destruction. Choose to escape, defending yourself like a gazelle from the hand of power, and similar to a chirping bird, a sparrow, from the fowler. Now, we did talk about this in our program a month or so ago, which is that these two animals that were chosen, the gazelle and the sparrow, they do not fend off their foes by through claw and fang, do they?
No.
They don't.
They run.
Strength and power.
Their defense is to get away.
They're the prey, not the...
Right. So their defense, their primary defense mechanism, is observation. That is their primary defense mechanism. It's very, very hard to sneak up on a gazelle or to sneak up on a sparrow. They're going to see you or hear you or smell you. They are observant. and particularly yeah, they have
to be because they have to escape. I mean, that's it. That's they're
right.
observing. It's just like
right.
we're escaping away from the nonsense, and we're observing the nonsense for what it is. I mean, that's how
right.
it has to be.
That's exactly right. So God wants us to be observant, and if you're observant, the second aspect of this is so the primary defense mechanism of these creatures, the gazelle and the sparrow, is that they are observant. The second is that because they have been observant, they're capable of processing a threat, recognizing a threat quickly, and they flee that threat quickly. So the speed to which they recognize and then flee the threat is the second aspect of their defense mechanism. So if we are also observant and come to know and distinguish between threats and non-threats, and we respond quickly and get out of harm's way, then we are following the example of the gazelle and the sparrow. You know, America said, okay, you know, these guys from the Islamic State that we created, by the way, when we invaded Iraq, and set off the Syrian war in the first place and the civil war in Iraq in the first place. But they showed some videos that report to be a beheading of a couple of Americans. So the response to them isn't to observe what they did and then distance ourselves from them, which would have been the intelligent thing. No, it was to strike back red in tooth and claw. And that's not, God's telling you that is the opposite response that is intelligent. Do not strike back in tooth and claw. You want to follow my advice, be observant, recognize the threats, and get out of the way.
Save the herd.
Right. Right. And that's not a cowardly thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. Yeah, it's the intelligent thing to do. You know,
I mean,
if you live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword.
Yeah. You're no match for that. You get in that and
right.
everybody
you know,
dies.
You look at the alligator or the crocodile that defends their territory by attacking any rival that comes into their territory. And, you know, they reach a time where they get injured. They reach a time when they get old,
mm-hmm.
and they die that way.
Well, you look at most every war in history, even the ones we quote-unquote won, you look at the amount of lives we lost. Did we really win? Were we any better coming out of it?
You tell me who won the Civil War.
Yeah.
You tell me how we won World War I when we launched a biological agent that killed 100 million people.
At least.
You know, how do we win World War II when we left the world worse than we found it with Communist China and the Soviet Union?
Well, we also used up 95% of our oil.
Yeah.
Which left us in where we had to negotiate with the Saudis.
Yep. So, God is providing us with a marvelous way.
We went that when we took out a secular dictator and implanted a religious leader.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, first of all, we're a lot better off
now. I'd like to just throw something out here. I don't think ISIS was just accidentally created. I think it was absolutely funded by the West.
Yeah, of course. Well, it was. The Islamic State is the awakening program that Petraeus and George Bush funded during the awakening program. The entire purpose of the awakening program was to provide bullets and guns to the highest-ranking Sunnis out of the disbanded Saddam Hussein Ba'ath Party so that they would have some ability to defend themselves against the Shia military that America had created, because we gave Iraq to Iran and then gave Iraq this mighty army and militaristic capability, and it was obvious they were going to use it to pummel Sunni communities. And so the response was, well, let's arm the Sunnis so that there is a stalemate as opposed to genocide.
And yes, and that's the excuse.
That's how we created
but,
the
but since
state,
these
the
people
Islamic
don't
state,
really, right? Since these people really don't care for other people, I don't buy it. I mean, that was the excuse used. The other thing that we know is that we're continuing to fight.
Oh, no,
that's
no, that
the insane.
The excuse was that we were arming them to go after Al-Qaeda. But there was
yeah,
no
right.
Al-Qaeda in
Excuse
Iraq.
Me.
And,
no,
and Sunnis would never go after Al-Qaeda, particularly militant Sunnis that you're arming, because the at the time, the finest expression of militant Sunni jihad was Al-Qaeda. It's just that Al-Qaeda didn't exist in Iraq. So that was the excuse. It's just that that wasn't the people who provided the weapons and the plan weren't so stupid as to actually believe the rhetoric they were using to justify it.
Right.
You remember the day
On shattering myths that $500 million was given to quote, Syrian rebels. I mean, that's
right.
ISIS. You know,
of course it is.
They're the ones beheading Christians and all this
stuff. Oh, yeah,
but,
and immediately, I said, it'll all go to the Islamic State.
And it did.
And then
they joined
America
them that day.
That of the $1 billion that it had spent training moderate rebels, that there wasn't a single moderate rebel to be accounted for, and that all the weapons they had provided and all the training migrated into the Islamic State.
Right, right. That
yeah.
day.
Yeah.
That day.
Yeah.
Once they got there. Oh, shit.
Larry, you can look up all the WikiLeaks stuff, and it'll tell you how the CIA and all planned everything and certain.
Oh, yeah.
And
the last book that Assange wrote based upon the planning of the Islamic State, it says specifically what you said, that there's an internal document that that WikiLeaks has released in the last book by Assange that goes through the United States position as it relates to Assad, and it said that America would fund a rift between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and would
right.
fund the Sunni Muslims to attack Assad, and then would plant all manner of rumors as to that would cause them to become so violent that there would be a civil war internally, with America providing the weapons to the Sunni Muslims to create this civil war against the Assad regime. And so this is before the invasion of Iraq. This is before the invasion of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
We planned it. What we are witnessing right now, it was an American plan. That's why Putin said, "Yeah, you know, this idea that you're of the CIA and America all over the Middle East. Everything you've touched, you've made worse." You know, we need a new plan, and it can't be the American plan. The habitually inactive and lethargic should see, observing and examining the movement of the ant and her ways, and be wise. So as we considered this some time ago, the first thing that we recognize is that her ways was profound, and that ants are 99% female, and that was not known until quite recently. So this was prophetic, showing that the author of this had an understanding of the animal kingdom that greatly exceeded the time. Right. But again, being inactive and lethargic, God does not want you to be a dependent. Doesn't want you to be a parasite. Not only were we designed to be active, to be engaged, to be doing things, God's preference is to be surrounded by people who are not lethargic, who are active and engaged. That's the people that are fun to spend time with.
Well,
you know,
it's
somebody that, you know, you have to motivate to get out of bed.
Lazy
in the morning.
People.
What's fun with that? But yeah, it's lazy. Gosh.
No, I mean, you know, I got to agree with this. I've been, you know, particularly injured here for some time, and I got to tell you, I don't find myself as being a hell of a lot of fun. Nothing
I did that
to be.
stuff that you used to be able to do.
Oh, God.
But there's a difference between having a physical limitation and longing to be active and not being able to. But what you're still doing is the place where that you're active is the place where it's important to be active with your eyes, with your mind, with your will.
At the same time, I mean, I don't want to sit here and feel like a hypocrite. I know one thing. I think what you're saying here is Yahweh doesn't want to be around a bunch of bums. And I'm not jumping people over the size of their wallets either. I'm talking about people who just flat out produce nothing. I mean, really, I think production's important. I mean, and producing his words are the most important thing in the universe right now.
Yeah,
I mean,
when I stopped working in business and started doing this, I don't think I've ever been more productive. I think this is a way. It's not about money. It's not about building a business.
It's about a loss of money for you.
Yeah, yeah, it's about using your eyes to observe and then to produce something that helps others understand. That's a really productive way to keep from being inactive and lethargic.
Yeah, and just so people know, and this has to be said, all the work that Yada/Craig does here is on his own dime. There's others that help, like Jackie is an example, and others, but that's on their own dime too. Everybody,
well, like Richard posts all of this. And Richard posts all of this on his own time.
And yeah, Richard does
in fact,
all
when
that
somebody
on his own
asks
time.
Richard about, you know, says something how thankful he is, and he says, "Hey, man, don't be thanking me." And they say, "I'd like to help you out." Richard said, no donations. I do this because I want to do it. I enjoy doing it. But you know, God is pretty harsh when it comes to accepting monetary gain. But
for sharing his words.
Do not think for a moment that somebody is good or somebody is doing something that is noble because you're sharing what Yahweh said.
Yeah.
We don't do it to be good. We don't do it to be noble. We do it because we enjoy it. It's not a sacrifice. You just do it because you enjoy doing it. It's the most fun thing we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's no sacrifice involved here. But the moment you accept money for it, you're in real trouble with God.
Yeah, just think how boring your life would be if all you did, you sat around and you translated and you studied, but you didn't share it with anyone.
Oh, I'd feel like a creep.
You'd go out of your mind.
Yeah, I'd feel like it's just a total and complete creep. Yeah, I couldn't do it. Yeah, I couldn't do it. Yeah, it wouldn't be any fun.
It wouldn't be any fun.
Yeah.
The
take all the joy
the
out.
Fun is learning and sharing and we all growing together. That's the fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it says, okay, so if you want to be wise, you want to look at the ways of the ant. Beneficially, and from a relationship perspective, she has no leader, no ruler, no commander, no officer, no government, no imposed authority. She has no work foreman, no public official, not even a clerk or scribe, or anyone claiming to be in charge or in control. Most especially, she doesn't have a lord who reigns over her. How do you like them, Alex?
That's a society I'm familiar with.
Wow. So God gets right to the heart of it. And you look at organizations. Are you aware of any human organization that doesn't have a hierarchy? You look at religion. The biggest religion in the world is Roman Catholicism. There's a pope, and he rules over the cardinals, who rule over the archbishops, who rule over the bishops, who rule over the priests, who rule over the nuns, who rule over the laity. That says, if you want to be wise, look at the ways of the ant. They don't have any of that. You look at governments. There is a hierarchy. In every government. And you look at the military. I mean, you couldn't have a more hierarchical organization than the world's military. Even police and sheriff. It's all a chain of command. You look at businesses. Chairman of the board. CEO. President. Executive vice president. Senior vice president. Executive vice president. directors, managers, foremen, worker bees. Goodness gracious. I mean, everything man does is a hierarchical structure. And God saying, you want to be wise? Don't go in for any of that. I mean, and he uses every word that he's got to say, no rulers, no leaders, no commanders, no officers, no government, no opposed authority, no public officials, no clerks, no scribes, no foremen. No one, anyone claiming to be in charge or control. And, you know, when he wrote this, do you think that anyone in the world understood that that's how ants acted? In fact, if you were to tell people that today, they'd say, well, that's not true. The ant has a queen.
I did that
queen.
The other day.
I want to tell you, the ants don't call her a queen.
No.
And she has absolutely no authority in the hive.
Running anything.
She didn't run
anything.
She's
a bee player.
She's got the world's worst job. She sits there in the dark and lays eggs. That's it. I mean, there is no authority, and we now know that.
Yeah.
We didn't know that then.
No.
So it's pretty hard to say that God is pro-government and pro-pope and the like when this says, you want to be wise, look at the relationship. You know, beneficially, she has no ruler, no commander, no officer, no government, no imposed authority over her.
Do you see how this ties in with no king we just finished?
Oh, I know. Yeah. That's why I wanted to get back and to finish Proverbs 6. And Proverbs 6 lays out everything that God's going to say in Yashaya 7 and 8. Because 7 is don't be religious, and 8 is don't be political. So Yashaya 7, don't be religious. Yashaya 8, don't be political. This proverb lays it all out. So this is we should have started. We actually did. It's just that I didn't know this proverb as well as I've come to know it. So the next part is we have created the world over entitlement societies. In the West, almost every society now is a society that redistributes wealth, that rewards failure and punishes success. And we have, you know, like as many as half of the people in society that do not contribute. They're net parasites, if you will. And if you look at the Islamic world, very few people actually work. They use ill-gotten gain, like from oil and gas, that others extract to hire people as virtual slaves. God is saying, no, no, no. What does the ant do? The ant prepares your food. Does it in the summer. She gathers in the harvest and stores her food as a source of nourishment. So this is communicating two things. One is don't be a parasite. I mean, go off and be productive. Do something. You know, if you're a net contributor, you're going to feel better about yourself. There's a reason there's such high drug use, such high alcoholism, such high suicide in the welfare-type communities in the inner city because they feel lousy about themselves. And it's a reason why very few people who engage in business and who are out doing stuff commit suicide or have to take drugs because they feel good about themselves because they're contributing something. So that's what said, not, but there's more to it.
No,
than that.
We go around with terminal headaches all day. I mean, that's all. That's all. We don't shoot ourselves. Other people shoot at us.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. Now, what this is also saying is that if you're prepared in advance, then you're not going to be found wanting. And there's a lot of people who are just not willing to invest the time to prepare in advance. You've got to be willing to read, to learn, to understand, so that when a situation arises, you're properly nourished, you're properly, you've stored up the ammunition that you need. You've gathered in and harvested the knowledge to be able to respond. And it's important to do that because, as I've said so many times, if you're in a situation where somebody brings up something that is religious or political, and if you're prepared in advance, you can respond to it. And on a 1 to 10 scale, a 2 as a response in a timely fashion is better than a 9 a week later. Prepare. Be ready. I think that's the underlying message that's here. So then he says, this is 6-9, for how long and to what extent, inactive, apathetic, and lethargic one, will lie there and remain inactive? When and what will it take for you to arise and stand up from your altered state of awareness? Now, Larry, before you get down yourself, this has nothing to do with being able to go off and do fun stuff like you used to be able to do before you were knocked down by injury. And James, the same thing. You know, you've had an injury where you can't be as active as you once were. This has nothing to do with physical activity. This has all to do with mental activity. You know, how long or to what extent are you going to be inactive, apathetic, lethargic? And it's what will it take for you to arise and stand up from your altered state of awareness? This is a mental exercise here. People are going through life comatose. That's the whole concept of political correctness, causing people not to be discerning, not to be judgmental, not to think about things, not to care that the message that they are hearing is contradictory. You know, this idea of you hating hate, the idea of being intolerant of intolerance. It's insane. So as Gus says, I want you to start thinking. I want you to arise. I want you to stand up. And the standing up has nothing to do with being on your feet. It has everything to do with the attitude of taking a stand.
This verse just reminds me so much of my family. I can talk with them and talk to them, and I get the same response. That's interesting. And then they have no interest in beyond going through there. If I'm not talking about it, they have no interest in studying on their own, reading on their own, learning anything for themselves, doing anything. They're just happy to, live their life in complete ignorance and apathy.
Yeah. Lisa wrote me the other day about trying to track down the source of the Philistines. And and there is a passage, and I think I even shared it in one of the programs, that talks about how they're a descendant of Mitzrayim via, and I've forgotten the group, and we really don't know how that migration took place. But the point is that she hears something and she goes right at it. She dives into the Torah, looking for answers.
But her and I worked on a note last weekend about it says right there that Judah invented all three of the religions. It describes them. I shot it over to you. I don't know if you read it or not.
No, I didn't see it. No, maybe
he named the three sons, and the one of the main names of one son is Wild Ass. That's one of the biggest meanings. I mean, the other one just denotes Rabbinic Judaism. The other one denotes Christianity.
Again, because for some reason I did not.
I will.
Me too, please. I would love to read it.
No, but she's.
I'll have her shoot him over.
She gets right into
it. Think she's a fighter? A little bit. Yeah. That's the truth.
And that's the right attitude. It's like Roy. You know, Roy is constantly digging into things and making the connections and then trying to share what he's learned. He can't help but want to share. And of course, to some degree, it's a challenge for Roy because he's so much smarter than the rest of us and better educated in his particular field, but yet he's extremely patient with us.
That's the truth.
He never makes you feel like he enjoys it.
He enjoys it. Okay, then God says a little inactivity leads to a little laziness. to folding one's hands together in a lethargic manner to rest. It plays on itself. You know, if you're active, you'll remain active. If you're lethargic, it's just you wind down, and after a while, you can't read, you can't study, you start reading and you fall asleep.
Isn't that pretty much Newton's law? You know, objects in motion stay in motion.
Yeah, there you go.
Stay at rest.
Yeah.
How many years before Newton did Yahweh coin this?
That's funny.
Very good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. For he will come, but the thing that's interesting is reading the book on chaos theory, almost everything that Newton wrote about has the Newtonian universe has been shown to be inaccurate. You know, Newton was, you know, if you could understand the universe at any one moment, you could understand it throughout all time. Newtonian explanation of the universe is not correct. For he will come, walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control. And you will lack what is needed and have a scarcity of something absolutely vital, needing what you do not have, causing you to be bereaved and diminished. This is 6:11. So when I said that this idea of the ant, pay attention to the ant, if the ant's not trying to rely on a hierarchical structure, being a bunch of people, you know, they read Questioning Paul, and they'll take a chapter to their pastor and ask their pastor what they think. And God is saying, you've got to do it. Don't rely on a hierarchical structure. But he's saying, you know, if you don't prepare in advance, this is what's going to happen to you. Someone's going to walk into this world behaving like a leader or guide, taking control. And you're going to lack what you need. You're going to have a scarcity of something that's vital to you, and you're going to be bereaved and diminished.
Every religious person on the planet.
Yeah. I can think of three people that meet this particular criterion. One would be, and the first of them would be Paul. He took control, saying that the Gentiles all belong to me. He acted like he was an apostle or leader and guide, and the vast majority of people lacked what was needed to be able to recognize him as a complete fraud. The next would be Rabbi Akiva, about half a century later, claiming that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah, and that the right way to deal with the enemy of Rome was to confront them mano a mano, spear to spear, sword to sword. And the consequence of the people not being prepared in advance is they missed the real Messiah, accepted the false Messiah, and they bought into Akiva's arguments, and they got pummeled.
Yeah, they should have known. If anybody
should have known better.
They should have known.
Yeah, they should have known better. And then you look at Muhammad. You know, the audience that Muhammad spoke to, we have three people who are listed in the Quran and Hadith who figured him out. Who said, you know, you're a complete con artist. Well, his neighbors, the Meccans, obviously knew him because it says all over the Quran that the Meccans recognized he was a fraud. But most people lacked the prior preparation to be able to recognize he came in acting like a messenger, a leader, a guide, taking control, and the people were unprepared to refute him. So those are three individuals here that, and the consequence of that. You know, when I see the bumper stickers for Obama, and I know that almost everything the man said is a lie, and he is an incompetent buffoon and an egotistical moron, completely disingenuous. And if you are a supporter, it means that you're just completely unaware. You're ill-prepared to be able to evaluate someone. And I would say the same thing of the Republican candidates. You know, people are swooning all over Ted Cruz and don't realize that almost everything he said is disingenuous.
I will say this. They're bad, but they're not as bad as the Obama people. And I'll tell you why. They get a little soundbite from Cruz here and there. Obama's already proven everything he says from start to finish is a lie. I saw one of those bumper stickers today, and I thought, at this point, if you can't get that off your car,
right,
buddy, burn the car. Are you
right.
that foolish?
Yeah. How could you be that
foolish? I had a guy last
stupid,
week.
Ignorant.
I had a guy last week, and I'm not kidding you. I was walking into a restaurant. I was traveling. It was on Sunday. And he says, hey, you want to sit down and eat with me? I said, sure. Yeah, why not? So I sat down, and I, of course, brought up Yahweh. We were actually discussing relativity and so forth. And I got into, this facet of the covenant, how we're to walk away from government and militarism and patriotism and religion. And he told me with a straight face, and believe me, anybody in this chat room or listening to this show or on this show would have fallen out of their seat. I just about did. He looked me straight in the face. He did not look mentally retarded. And he said to me that he looks at the government like a father there to protect him. And he said that to me. I said,
well,
are you
straight
kidding?
Out of Romans.
I asked him if he was kidding. And he said,
that's no. Romans 13.
And I got up and left. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe anybody would even say that. I'll stop right there. But, I mean, there you go. There's somebody ill-prepared, you know.
Ill-prepared.
In a major
they were
way.
Improperly equipped to process information rationally, either unaware, and they are unaware, and also irrational.
Well, you know, those are like great examples where they fooled millions, but really every single pastor, every single priest would fall under this same category. I mean,
correct.
How many times have you had a conversation with someone and heard these words? That's interesting. I'll have to ask my pastor about that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I could turn it into a drinking game.
Yeah, you have better odds with a pong or something. Yeah. So then this.
Well, at least
this
at the end of the conversation, I got a good buzz going, and I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
Instead of opposed to being frustrated and upset.
People are ill-prepared when the scumbags come along and they believe them. I mean, it's so obvious that they're lying. When I finally became prepared with the Torah, it was obvious that Paul was a liar. Prior to studying the Torah, I was incapable of recognizing that. But God wants us to be prepared in this regard. Now, it's from this point on that this proverb really gets interesting. And obviously, we're out of time for today. We're going to pick this up on the observations program next weekend and continue with it on this program. But God's going to get all the way to calling Paul the lowly and little one, and he's going to go through a list of attributes that there's only one person in all of human history that meets. And so this fatherly advice ultimately comes down to don't be a Christian.
You know, when you first did Chabuk, I thought to myself, well, that is just so bold. I mean, Paul is right there, and you can't miss it. I can't hardly find – I can find him just about everywhere now. But these last
not
two,
everywhere.
Just
yeah.
About these last two, today's morning stuff we were doing, or afternoon stuff
yeah.
we were doing, and this one, I mean, it's just – Paul is just – I was told everybody to stay away from this guy.
Yes.
This is so
yes.
obvious. And
yes. And the reason that he has is that there is no one in all of human history that has had as negative an influence as Paul, both on the Gentiles, but also on Yisrael and Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is the person who spoke out against the birthright. He's the person who condemned the covenant. He's the person who annulled the Torah. I mean, there is no one in all of human history that was as disastrous, because it's not just like Muhammad, where you come up with some moronic, just absolutely despicable religious notion based upon stealing and terrorism, and tell everybody that stealing is good and terrorism is good. That's bad. But
to create
a religion that completely negates everything that God says, to call his testimony pornography, to annul his covenant, to say his covenant is slaves, and then to replace those things with his gospel of grace. There is nothing that you could have done more debilitating to humankind than what Paul did.
You know, Satan's finest hour.
Yes, Christianity is Satan's finest hour. There's no question about it. There's a reason that that he possessed Paul. Paul was.
Oh, I have a note called Satan's Masterpiece, and it just describes
it
Christianity
is.
Totally.
It is.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. It's because it shows Yahweh's words, and then it shows the total opposition.
Yeah.
And you know, one after another. I only do three. You have to keep notes short, or people don't read them. And it's astonishing.
It's Satan's Masterpiece. There's no place. And this whole proverb describes the nature of Satan in religion, and how the whore presents herself as beautiful, as believable, as credible, as somebody
loving,
that's going to make you feel good, loving and caring. And that's how Satan wants to be known. Because when you do that, you'll swoon to him. You'll respect him. You'll place him as, treat him as if he were God. And,
you know, that's, I got a question here for you. This is just an opinion. Anybody chime in. This is a, we know that the upper elite, they're really Illuminists. They sing about Lucifer. They claim to be Luciferian in the whole bit. Why do you think that, is this just another manipulation, or do you think they actually think that there's a Lucifer who's, we know his real name's Halal Ben Shakar. They call him Lucifer.
Right.
He went by many names, though.
Right.
I mean, what the hell?
Yeah. But, you know, Lucifer appears where Halal Ben Shakar is written. And the reason that it is Lucifer is loosened in Latin, because it all comes from the
is light.
Okay.
Yeah, bringer,
is light.
Bearer,
so
light,
it is light bearer.
Bearer.
And
yeah.
Light bearer is not a translation of Halal bin Shakar, although Halal does mean to can mean to radiate light. But the light bearer is the Illuminist concept that, and it's how Paul said that he saw Satan on the road to Damascus as flashing light. And so, and honestly, Satan is light.
Yeah, but Michael,
all
yeah,
of those
of course.
Things, you know, yeah, he is. So, and his whole idea is he wants to come across as the one who enlightens. So,
Okay, so you know you're getting in bed with Satan.
Right.
Of course, they won't call Lucifer Satan. They won't call him the enemy. They won't do that. You know, they call him Lucifer. But they're going to get in bed with him and think things are going to turn out any different for them than, say, they did for Hitler. You know, I mean,
I think they just assume they're enlightened.
Or do you think they just
don't
believe
it? I don't think they're that deep.
So you just think they just don't believe it?
No, I think they believe it's a society of enlightenment, and if there's a spirit somewhere, it's enlightening them.
You know, you ask a great question, which is, what is it that causes the elite to somewhat knowingly align themselves with Satan?
Yeah, like
and,
when you go out to the Bohemian Grove
And the commonality of the men that are attracted to this. Yeah, with
power, sex.
First of all, they all have enormous egos.
Mm-hmm.
And they want their egos stroked. They want power. They want control. They want to be perceived as something that they are not. And they're infatuated with deception. And, you know, that's why the Bohemian Grove, they'll never share what is written. That's why the Freemasonry, that's all secrets. And so they share all of those common traits, a desire for power, for influence, the willingness to use deception, enormous egos, wanting to be perceived as something that they're not. They share all of those things with Satan. So they're naturally inclined to behave that way, to associate with the similar kinds of people. So they've brought their God into their midst. It's just that their God is a projection of themselves, and the projection of such people is identical to the nature of Satan. So it's if you look at Muhammad, Muhammad modeled Allah after Satan because Muhammad was just like Satan. The God of Christianity is modeled after Satan because Paul shared all of Satan's characteristics. Mm-hmm. So these men create a God in their image. And the image of such men just happens to be, the character of such men happens to be identical to Satan. So they may very well view that they are serving, worshiping, hanging out with the God of enlightenment. It's just that their God was modeled in their image, made in their image, just like the Pauline God was made in Paul's image. The Islamic God was made in Muhammad's image. The Bohemian group's God, the elite's God, is made in their image.
There are
so you think so you think they don't really think there's an entity. They just it's an image
right.
They've made up. That's how they
correct.
See it.
Yeah, that is a
so they don't believe it's even real.
The highest thing by far, the thing that Paul, Muhammad, and these individuals care about the most is what?
Themselves.
Correct. Themselves. And they are despicable. They are dishonest. Mm-hmm. They're power hungry. They're controlling. They're manipulative. They're dishonest. And so, since the highest calling in their lives is to promote themselves and is a fixation on themselves and aggrandizing themselves, they are their own God, and that God happens to model, be identical to the adversary.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, that's well put. Nobody's ever really given me that answer because I kept thinking, well, I mean, obviously they don't believe there's a real entity called Lucifer, or maybe they do.
I don't think they do.
Because I've always wondered how does anybody...
I think they think so in Freemasonry, because in the 32nd degree Freemason... and particularly as part of the, at least the original writers, they finally admit that the God that they are worshiping is Lucifer, but they say that because the fact that they will call him Lucifer and not Satan, because he wants to be known as the light, not the adversary. Yeah. So they are correctly seeing Satan for what he is.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a fellow that wrote a book called God to My Right, and he was a 33rd degree Mason. I mean, that's, and when he finally got to where he was, he realized exactly where he was. And of course, now he really actually opposes it. That's why he exposed it in the book. But I just always wondered how somebody gets in bed with dogs and expects not to get fleas. I mean, that's my thing there. I mean, how do you do that? I just don't understand.
Yeah. But, most people, very few people, are irrational. Most people are irrational. Most people can't get out of the way of their own selves. And so this is a fairly common viewpoint. Now, the difference with the elite and the masses is the masses want to collectively worship a God made in the image of man. They want to belong to that. The masses want to, or the elite want to rise above it. So, and the masses is the religious God, and with the elite, it's a God that is identical to them.
Yeah, well, I think they got to a point where they say, okay, you know, we've got enough information, say, as an example, about Christianity or even about Rabbinic Judaism or whatever, that we know that this is all just a bunch of hooey that was thrown together and created a power base that we can use to manipulate people. Thus, none of this is true. I just don't think that they've done any, obviously, they've not done the investigation we've done. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
No.
And so
they would
that
have no
leads them
in that because they don't want right. to be influenced by a real God. They wouldn't even like a God the way he is because God would besmirch everything they stand for. So they don't want to know him. They wouldn't like him. He'd be interfering. So they don't want to know him. They don't want to they wouldn't want to do this research. They find no pleasure in it.
Right. But I would think somebody would just get some pleasure just out of the truth. I think what's happened here is they say, well, we know all this is manipulatory. And in reality, I mean, it is. I mean, it's like going to an atheist post. And you ever go to an atheist page? I looked at one of them today. I mean, all they do is not religion. And
right.
then they equate religion to God, not
right.
knowing that God is more anti-religion than they could ever hope to be.
Right.
Hope to be
right.
including
yeah.
their
every and
yeah.
it's filled with half truths and attacks on religion. And their attacks on religion are reasonable.
Are usually spot on.
It's just yeah. that they but they associate God with religion and God disassociates himself from religion.
Right.
So
which is what my dad did. He couldn't separate out God from religion. Thus, he became his own God. You know, I mean, really, in a sense.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a. It was just a question I had laying out there. I just could never figure why anybody would honestly do that to themselves, you know. But,
yeah.
you know, they just don't believe anything. I think basically they're nihilists or something, you know. They just don't have any belief whatsoever.
Yeah, with the Paul, this proverb is actually going to get into what was Paul's motivation? Why did he do this? And according to Yahweh, it was envy. He is envy. He was envious of God. And so he lashed out at him because he was envious of God. Now, you look at what got Satan into trouble. He was envious of God.
Same thing.
So the man and the beast that he is serving, same characteristics. Exact same problem. So I think that is the answer that God is giving us. It was envy is why he did it. And
it's just pretty bizarre that anybody could actually think that they could put Halal Ben Shikar at the center of their universe and get anything but bad things out of it in the end. You know, I think they just look at short-term gain and believe in nothing at all. I guess that is the answer, and you're right. They reflect their own thoughts, the making of their own God is their own image.
It gives them what they're looking for.
Yeah, sure.
That's
sure.
what they're looking for. They're looking for power and influence in the here and now. They're looking for pleasure in the here and now.
They seem to take pleasure out of pain, though, that they cause others too.
But
I think they get a lot of pleasure out of
it. That Satan doesn't satisfy.
That's right.
People all die miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're miserable. There is no satisfaction in it. So it is a thirst for earthly power and satisfaction and influence and esteem and pleasure, and yet they never find it. You know, the difference is that God offers the real thing, and he's dependable, and Satan is the illusion of it. You know, it's always the hint and the promise of it, but no substance.
Yeah, they're just so stupid. I guess in the end, as bright as they think they are, and let's face it, most of them, you know, have the wealth handed to them and the power positions handed to them anyway. Very few of them actually work their way into it. But these people are not very bright other than, you know, they're surrounded with people that are a bunch of legalists and lawyers and write the laws and take care of them, and they're, in the end, not very bright people at all.
No. And certainly disgusting.
Oh, yeah.
I
mean,
how fancy the cars, how gilded the houses, how lavish the bank accounts.
And then you have to protect your family because you know that the guy next to you is just like you are.
That's right.
Right?
Oh, yeah, they're never comfortable.
No,
they're never comfortable.
Be.
Right. And, you know, they build a big house. Most of these guys, like you look at the Gilded Age and go to the homes in Rhode Island, for example, that they all built to impress the other one. And almost none of them spent more than a weekend or two in those houses.
Afraid.
No pleasure in them. They built all this, spent all this money, built all these magnificent, I think they're hideously ugly, but all of these big houses, and they were there for a few days here and there, and that was it. And then almost all of them, shortly thereafter, they died, and then their wives went off and married somebody else and didn't work out. And it's a whole history of just pain and no pleasure at all. No satisfaction.
Wow. Yeah, I guess that's all true. I guess they just decided the only truth there is how much they can steal from others. I think.
Yeah. Okay. But let me give you an example here. When I finally confronted Jerry Falwell, I mean, he couldn't be any higher in his profession than he was. Founder of
big
university and
politically known on every talk show back
known,
then.
Sort of being the Pope.
Internationally known. Having one of the first to be one of the first televangelists in the world. I mean, he was the top of his craft, and here I refute everything that he says and does, everything he stood for, and laid it all bare. And he acknowledges, yeah, that's all true, but he couldn't get off of that treadmill. He couldn't get off. And I think that's true of the elite that you talk about. That, yeah, they come to realize that it's all for naught. And
when you look at, I looked at a flyover over one city in Syria and then over Damascus. You know, these were flyovers with Russian drones or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got entire major cities in Syria, not just Damascus.
Gone.
You know, major cities that are uninhabitable. I mean, there's nobody in them.
One of the great examples is Fallujah and Ramadi. And the Islamic State was finally kicked out of Ramadi, for example. And you know how they did it?
They just leveled the entire place.
Place is gone. There's nobody there.
Yeah.
There's no buildings there. It's just gone.
Scorched earth.
Scorched earth. You know, they say, well, you know, I want to eliminate Islamic terrorism. Well, there's one way to do it. That is that you use nuclear bombs, and you completely destroy the Middle East. Now, what a horrible way to go about it. I mean, if obliterating life is the best answer you got, you don't have an answer. And that's what they did with Ramallah, Fallujah, and the Sunni areas they took back from the Islamic State is they just killed everybody. Hey, there's literally nothing left of those places. They're gone.
Well, no, I mean, you look at these cities in Syria and you go, well, let's see, you're claiming that it's the Assad regime you're after, right?
Right.
And you're saving the people from the Assad regime. So you destroy the entire city. Obviously, all these people must have been happy with Assad or you wouldn't be wiping them all out. I mean, they're uninhabitable cities. I mean, obviously, there's no electricity. There's no windows. There's no water. There's a whole lot of rubble, you know.
Right.
And so you look at this and you think, how can people in power really do this to millions and millions of people? Well, somehow they're enriching themselves, probably through the purchase of the bombs and weaponry and whatever else. You know, some taxpayer somewhere, or you know, somebody's labor is being robbed.
Yeah.
You know, and they're being enriched. And so, for enrichment of yourself to go out and kill a million people or whatever it is, wow,
yeah,
wow, huh? I mean,
oh, yeah.
That really
look at our invasion of Iraq. Yeah, as a result of our invasion of Iraq, a million people are dead, and 12 million people are homeless. For what?
Well, somebody enriched themselves. I mean, that's
certainly
the purpose of war.
Lots of money changed hands.
Yeah, that's why. That's it.
But, oh my God.
I mean, these guys are really you can't
yeah, you
say
cannot
big
destroy and bomb oneself into success.
No, and you can't. I don't think words can
you
describe
don't resolve the Sunni Shia conflict by obliterating cities.
I think words,
God's really clear here. That's not the approach.
Words are too
lacking
for these people. Yeah. Can you imagine? And then you go out and vote for these people? No, I mean, really. Worldwide.
I don't think there's a better example of the counterproductive nature of governments and militaries and religions than there is in what we have, the mess we have made in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, et al.
Africa.
Yeah, throughout Africa. Yeah. Look at the mess we've made. And we've always got, you know, running to justify it. Can't wait to justify it. And they look at the rhetoric of all these political candidates. Yeah, we need more of it.
We need more.
More military, more bombs, more troops on the ground, more fighting. That's kind of the very thing that's made every mess they want more of.
Oh, well, you know that's what they're going for, and you know how I know it. I mean, just look at every other movie. You know, for a long time, it was not popular to be in the military, as an example, when I was in.
Yeah.
You know, today, it's very popular to be in the military.
Oh, yeah. You're, people thank you. They show reverence to you. And what's happened is so interesting, too, is it used to be that the Democratic Party and the liberals were anti-military, no more military spending, and a disrespect of the military. And the Republican, Christian Republican right were, you know,
right.
Military is everything. It is the, you know, it's the sum total of godliness. But today, the left and the right are equally respectful of and reverent of the military. Something profoundly changed, and that the left has embraced the military because it's the ultimate control mechanism. So it's really profoundly different, and we've actually gone to the point where we ascribe to the military the very thing that it does not do. We ascribe our freedoms and thank them for fighting for our freedoms, when in fact they have never done that. And they are the reason Yahweh was so opposed to the government in Israel is he said the first thing they're going to do is they're going to take your sons, they're going to build weapons, and they're going to go deploy them. They're going to take your freedom, take your lives. And that's the truth of the military. It's counterproductive. It takes away freedom. It's to empower the leaders so that no one has the ability to rebel against them.
Well, I'm not asking for an answer, but I'm amazed that we went from Vietnam era to this era on that view.
Yeah, without learning anything.
Just go
ahead. How do you go from the disaster of Vietnam, where you know for a fact that you engaged based on a lie, that you were that you failed in every possible way, you made a bad situation worse, you sacrificed the lives of millions of Vietnamese and lost 60,000 American boys and girls in the process, making a bad situation worse, and then you go and do exactly the same thing in Afghanistan and Iraq and make a bigger disaster. And so your answer in Libya is to do the same damn thing.
Well, no, you went into the White House and you told them that's what would happen. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yada
the Navi.
Yada the Navi. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, well, yeah, no Navi here,
I'm
read Navi.
I'm kidding.
But I read Navi.
Yeah,
the Hebrew word for prophet. Yeah, I read Navi.
Yeah, but it was straightforward. You presented that
George
Bush
exactly
what was happening.
Yeah, I read Navi.
Very prophetic, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Well, because I read Navi.
Yeah, I know.
I observe what Yahweh said through his prophets. Makes you pretty smart. That's what it means to be prepared in advance. Yep, and that's what it means to stand up. That's what it means to give them a reason that you're in opposition to them.
Can I ask you what they said to you at the end of that? I mean, I understand what Falwell said to you at the end of it. I'm guessing you probably had a more thoughtful approach to it in the White House. How about they told you they appreciated you coming in and sharing your thoughts, right?
No.
Or am I wrong?
No.
Oh, really? So they didn't even appreciate that?
No. It is a position where everyone I spoke to said, if we were to acknowledge anything that you've said here, we would be fired.
Just like that, huh?
Absolutely. We can't even allow ourselves to think this way. We're not going to engage you in discussion or argument, or we're not going to pursue this. We're not going to even think about it, because any of those things would cause us to lose our job. There can be absolutely no connection between Islam and terrorism if you want to keep your job in the military, in the intelligence community, or in the political office.
Even in the intel community?
Especially in the intel community.
Wow.
Mm. Yep. Cannot do it. What I ended up getting is, later on, I got a number of letters from people who left the community and said, you were right. And let me give you, and then they would give personal examples and said, yeah, everything you said was correct. But not while they were employed, because it would immediately cost them their job. And the people that would write back would all say that they came to realize what I said was true, and that when they tried to bring it up, they confronted such hostility that the only thing they could do is resign before they were fired.
So there were people that lost their jobs over it.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there were a couple
of
people that stood up.
For example, is banned by the U.S. military. You can't bring up the site profit from any government or military computer. Banned. It's illegal.
Wow.
Truth is not popular.
No, it's not. We got a group called the Unpopular Truth, and we're a pretty small group for as long as we've been around.
Yeah, pretty small group. That's the way it is. All right, fellas. Well, thank you.
Enjoy the beginning.
Yeah, me too.
That's enlightening. Thank you.
Yes, I hope you
put together a very good note. It's out there, and other people that haven't listen to the show, they'll have an opportunity to read it if they want to.
Yeah. I guarantee you that our, as we progress here in this proverb, it gets really intense. You're going to like it a lot. So we've got a lot to learn. It's a marvelous, marvelous proverb, and we're only, 12 verses or something into it. Yeah, so, and it's 35 or 36. We're not, even though we're a third of the way through in terms of information, we're not a third of the way through in terms of what we can glean from it.
By the way, that note I sent you, it was called non sequitur. The definition of non sequitur being the Abrahamic religions. it's definitely non sequitur. So there, it'll come at you that way again. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You betcha.
All right.
Good
night.
Good long, guys. I hope you two guys are feeling better, JB and
I think JB is disconnected, but yeah.
Now, I never feel better, but I feel okay right now.
Okay. Well, I hope you feel a little more okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Kurt.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, kids. See you later.
Bye.
Bye, y'all.